The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place, so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month, so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
From the number one sports site in the world.
Big names.
Bold interviews.
Beyond the X's and O's.
Welcome to the fastest 2 hours in radio.
On Yahoo Sports Radio.
And yahoosportsradio.com.
This is the Big E Sports Show.
With the one and only, the triple threat, the Big E.
Alyssa Walker-Campbell. The 6 foot former Sooner women's basketball player.
She can post, pin,
turn the volume up,
and produce with some of today and yesterday's biggest stars.
Alyssa Walker-Campbell delivers sports the way you want it. Get ready to go beyond the X's and O's.
With today's star athletes, coaches, and sports figures.
This is the Big E Sports Show.
Right now.
Now from the Quicken Loans studios of Yahoo Sports Radio.
Are you ready?
Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze.
Here she is, the one and only, the Big E, Alyssa Walker-Campbell.
Okay, March Madness continues at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. We're so glad you made it a point to join us this evening. Connect with us at Twitter right now, at E Radio Sports. And what a weekend it is going to be in Dallas with the men's Final Four getting underway. Big time expectations. You got quality teams and matchups, Florida, Kentucky, Wisconsin, and UConn. There is so much anticipation. And so we're going to get you ready in our next segment. We've invited back my buddy Steve Bortstein from Fox Sports Radio in New Mexico, who has been tracking the teams very, very closely. Good to have you with us tonight, Steve. Thank you so much.
Good to be back with you, Alyssa. Nice to have me back, I guess.
I lost that whole opening
right there.
We love having you on because you always bring it, that insight, that perspective. But before we do break it all down and the matchups, I am just out of curiosity, Steve, how did your bracket play out? I mean, who did you select to win it all?
I had Arizona winning it all.
Wow, okay.
My Elite Eight adventure came to a tragic, tumultuous end. And, you know, what a game that was between Arizona and Wisconsin, that the controversy in the end of the game there. So, you know, the overtime. So it's a bitter loss. It's my it ends my two-year win streak of bracket pool that I get into with friends of mine around here. So that's okay. It's time someone else won it.
Well, let's talk about the top four teams that survived and emerged from the group of 68 and now have a legitimate shot. I think any one of them have a legitimate shot at winning a national title. But let's start off, Steve, if it's okay with you, I'd like to start with Kentucky because big expectations coming into the season. They had a phenomenal recruiting class that had been hyped really as perhaps the Fab Five back in Michigan in those early 90s. But why did it take so long for the Wildcats to live up to that building?
I think because it took a while for this team to learn to play as a team. And I think that's, you know, it's no longer that they're freshmen. You know, that, I think we have to get past that notion that they're freshmen. They've been doing this now since November. It's now early April. So we're talking about nearly 6 months. So, yeah, they're freshmen technically, but, you know, you get that time together and you build that chemistry and you build that rapport. And, you know, this is, like you mentioned, this is the most talented team of individuals. And now that they've learned to play like a team, we saw that come together. We saw that come together against Wichita State. We saw that come together against Louisville. And now we're seeing it even more, you know, as we move on through this tournament. And if they can continue to play that way, if John Calipari can keep this team's head together, you know, as a collective unit, I think they have a very legitimate chance of cutting down the nets next Monday.
Well, Steve, it was quite a resurgence. And John Calipari, he was able to get his guys into sync. I mean, they're inexperienced, young. They were talented players. But I'd really love for you to talk about as far as chemistry, because that's the real trick. I mean, when you're going to translate that talent from paper onto the court, you've got to be cohesive, and timing is everything, and how they really blossomed and came together. It was remarkable to watch.
It's Aaron and Andrew. I mean, the Harrison twins have just really become those guys that we expected them to be. And I think what I've seen over the last couple of weeks has been Andrew Harrison. It's been his really resurgence here that's really impressed me here. He's gotten that element. Now, I think Aaron always had the ability to, you know, to be the team leader. And I think Andrew has just kind of learned it along the way. You know, I don't want to say that one's more mature than the other, but I think one's more mature than the other, and I think we've watched the maturation process now of Andrew Harrison. He's been key to the resurgence here, and I think as long as he stays being the facilitator, so long as he's not the guy trying to force up shots like we saw back in December and we saw back in January and February, I think if he stays as being the facilitator, again, I think the Harrison twins, you know, take this team, then obviously they have taken this team to this next level.
Steve Borstein joining us this weekend at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. He is with Fox Sports Radio out there in New Mexico. It's interesting because you're highlighting, talking about Andrew Harrison, the growth and how we've seen him evolve as a player. But Aaron Harrison, how about that game winner? That is what lifted Kentucky over Michigan and into the Final Four.
And that is just that was an absolute man moment right there.
It was.
I mean, to get into that position and to put that shot up with a hand in your face with 3 seconds to go. It goes in with 2.3 seconds. And, you know, again, I thought what was impressive was immediately after that play is over, and immediately after the initial exultation of that moment, you know, John Calipari got them all together. Okay, here's what we need to do. We got 2 seconds. Get in your role. Know your role. Know your position. They're going to launch up something deep. Just be ready, you know. And I think that's what we're seeing here. The Aaron Harrison shot, you know, he's become the clutch shooter. He's delivering 3-point daggers against Louisville and, like you mentioned, against Michigan a moment ago. And he's just that guy now. But you need to have it's you know this, Alyssa. It's a team game. And you've got to have, you know, Aaron Harrison doesn't make that play unless Andrew and the rest of his teammates make the plays to get them into that position.
We're certainly highlighting some of the players for Kentucky, but just the job that Coach Calipari has done, you really have to give him a lot of credit. I mean, he's taken the Wildcats, what, to 3 Final Fours in the last 4 years. It's his 5th year as a head coach. Just your thoughts on the job that he's done, just overall, as we step back and look at him as a recruiter and his ability to connect with his players.
Well, I mean, and is he not the coach most under the microscope of probably any men's college basketball coach in the country? And the job he does every year, because don't forget, he's obviously the most hated man, you know, among college recruiters, because he gets all the talent, and now you're seeing why he gets that talent, because, you know, it's the artist, it's the person who takes a mold of clay and turns it into a sculpture, and that's what he's done here. You know, he took this talented group of individuals and molded them into something that, you know, looks pretty formidable right now, and that's not just a recruiter, that's a guy who, you know, who's a teacher, that's a guy who's a father, that's a guy who, you know, can instruct and can mold and can teach and guide this team, and that's what he's done so far. I mean, I sound like I'm, you know, standing on the John Calipari pulpit here, but it's amazing what he's done. It really is. I mean, it's pretty sensational what he's done, you know, and it's not just this season. You mentioned, I mean, it's for the last 5 years. He's had these teams before. We see it every year, and he just knows how to motivate, and that's a hard thing to do, especially at the college level, all the distractions that come along with the tournament, all the distractions that come along, you know, with being a successful college basketball player in this day and age. Look, there's a lot of things that can distract you, but he's done, I think, an amazing job in keeping this team and their focus, you know, on the big prize.
Well, Kentucky has certainly had an amazing turnaround. They had to muscle through some difficult stretches, but I think what I appreciate, too, is just listening to some of these press conferences and going back through the files, just the humility that he has shown in terms of he shoulders the blame for the team not playing to its potential a few months back, that he said that he waited too long to instill and to tweak some things.
Yeah, it's funny. I mentioned that, you know, on my show the other day, there was a great soundbite of his about, You know, he never thinks about this team losing. He never talks about losing. They never look at a game as what they have to overcome. It's always the case of, you know, looking ahead to how long it's going to take to get the win and what it takes to get the win. And, you know, when you're an 18-year-old kid, and even if you're facing, you know, what appear to be insurmountable odds, I know they heard all the stories about the Kentucky-Louisville matchup, and they know what happened last year when these two teams squared off. You know, they had the Kentucky-Michigan matchup and all the, you know, the fact they were without one of their top players, and Willie Cauley-Stein, and, you know, how much of that was going to be an impact. But, you know, John Calipari has been that calming presence. He's been that guy who, you know, shows the confidence, and therefore that confidence then comes out in his players.
Tell us about, Steve, kind of break it down for us. How do you see this matchup playing out between Wisconsin?
You know, I think the we mentioned a moment ago, Willie Cauley-Stein. I think now is where we're going to see him not being around, because he got the injury against Louisville the other night. If he can't play, and what we're hearing right now is that he won't play, him not being there, that's going to be a problem, because Wisconsin is so big inside that it's the shot-blocking presence that Willie Cauley-Stein brings to the table. He's averaging over 3 blocks a game. Him not being there, that allows Wisconsin to establish themselves under the boards. And yes, you know, Kentucky is an extraordinary rebounding team, but at some point in time, Wisconsin also is going to force things in the inside. And I think that's where Wisconsin has an advantage here. I think that's where, you know, Wisconsin to me has the advantage. If they can get a presence on the inside and they can muscle their way through, I think they're going to be very tough to beat here.
It is our Final Four coverage this weekend at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. Steve, stick with us. We got to take a quick commercial break. We'll be rejoining with Steve Bortstein from Fox Sports Radio New Mexico here in just a minute on the Big E Sports Show.
You're listening to the Big E Sports Show
on Yahoo Sports Radio.
Once again, the host of the fastest 2 hours in radio, here's Alyssa Walker-Campbell.
The Big E.
Okay, the conversation continues as we break down the Final Four at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. We're giving you the full preview, going full court, and we are visiting with Steve Bortstein from Fox Sports Radio out in New Mexico. We were just talking about, before we went to commercial break, Kentucky and how they have arrived at their big moment. Let's transition now. Let's talk about Wisconsin. What a great story, Steve. I mean, Bo Ryan has a strong reputation for excellence with this club, but this is his first trip to the Final Four, and what an incredible season it has been for him.
And I've always been a big fan of Bo Ryan, and I'm so glad now that, you know, on the national level, he's going to get a chance to show off here. This is a very good team. This is a balanced team. With the exception of the first half against Oregon earlier in this tournament, I think it was back in the second round,
yeah.
Wisconsin's defense has just been outstanding here. Josh Gasser, who I think is probably one of the best defenders in the country, he's amazing to me, and he drew the critical charge on Nick Johnson in overtime of that Wisconsin victory over Arizona. And I think that, you know, he's just one of those guys right now. The problem that they're going to have, the problem that Wisconsin has going into this is Frank Kaminsky's not going to be able to get 20 points a night like he's been getting, you know, early in this tournament. He got the 28-point variety earlier in this tournament, but he's such a big matchup problem. And, I mean, who do you put on him? What defender on Kentucky do you put on him? Because he can do so many different things. He can go to the outside. He can go to the inside. He's a good perimeter guy. He can penetrate. I think that's, you know, the success of Wisconsin from an offensive standpoint is going to really come down to just how hot Frank Kaminsky gets in this game.
Well, I love the versatility of Wisconsin offensively, but I'll tell you what, they really get after it defensively. I mean, they can be very dangerous on the defensive end.
Well, and they don't commit fouls. That's mm-hmm. the amazing part about
that. They play smart.
They don't commit a lot of fouls. They rank fourth now. They rank fourth in the country in fewest turnovers per game. So, you know, where do you find the weakness here? They don't turn the ball over. They play tremendous defense. They frustrate everybody, and that's the beauty of that team. Is, you know, it really is a work in progress. And unlike Kentucky, you know, who it seems that they do a lot of their offense sort of fly by the seat of their pants. They create moments. Wisconsin is deliberate. Wisconsin is very purposeful in what they do. They have set plays. They run those set plays. Those set plays work. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how, from a defensive standpoint, Kentucky adjusts to that because they like to play more of that up-tempo thing, whereas Wisconsin is deliberate, they're tactical, they're surgical, and they're precise.
Final Four coverage continues at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. Going one-on-one, I'm posting up Steve Wordstein from Fox Sports Radio out there in New Mexico. And so, Steve-O, what do you see as the key to be able to stop and minimize Kentucky from going off?
I think for Wisconsin here, you just got to keep putting the ball in the air. I think if you're Kentucky, you let shots happen. Ben Bruff leads the team as far as three-pointers are concerned. You know, they don't have the deep roster that Kentucky has, but the seven or eight guys that they do have, you know, they shoot 32% from three-point range. The only person who does it is freshman fella Nigel Hayes, who hasn't attempted a shot from there all season. If they can get Sam Decker going offensively, he's going to be a factor. I think the key to Wisconsin is, you know, the thing I like, you know, what was so great about that Kentucky-Michigan game is that each team got a little bit of a run. They never got too far ahead. They never got too far behind. Kentucky can't get frustrated. If they get frustrated, Wisconsin's going to beat them down. And if Wisconsin gets a big lead here, they're going to slow things down. They're going to be deliberate. They'll be tactical. And that's going to be, I think, the undoing there of Kentucky. So for me, I want to see Kentucky get out early, be confident. Don't worry if shots don't fall in early. They will fall in. Just stay close and keep it, you know, and don't change your pattern. Don't get out of that tactical, purposeful rhythm that I liked that's what I liked to have seen of them so far this tournament.
Okay, so we already hit on the late game, talking about Wisconsin and Kentucky. Now let's go to talking about Florida and Connecticut. And I have to tell you, Steve, Florida is my pick to win it all. They are my favorite. And it's interesting because when you look at the start of the season, the Gators came into this year, they lost their top three scorers. But once again, you tip your hat to Billy Donovan. He knows how to refuel. What is your belief in this team and what they'll be able to accomplish at the Final Four?
What I liked about this Florida team was after they had that kind of dull sort of, you know, just sort of meandering victory in the first round of the tournament when they beat up on Albany. And after the game, Billy Donovan chewed out his team, you know, on CBS television, and he was very unhappy with the performance. And, you know, it came across, I think, loudly, not just to fans and to critics, but it also came across to his team. And since that time, they posted up three double-digit victories over Pittsburgh, UCLA, and then Dayton. And what I've seen from this team is, again, much like John Calipari, you know, over in Kentucky, it's been Billy Donovan and the maturation progress here of this Florida team. And I would agree with you here about Florida here. They're one of three teams with a 30-game win streak going into the Final Four. The others, while they didn't win the national championship, all got to the point of having a shot at a national championship. They don't have players that are going to be considered, you know, the elite level at their respective positions, but collectively, what they do collectively as a unit is so formidable, and I think that's what makes them so much fun to watch, is that they don't have that one standout, you know, Shabazz Napier. They don't have that one standout Harrison Twins. They don't have that one standout Kaminsky. But what they do have is a collective unit that's functional enough, you know, that makes them so dangerous.
Well, that collective unit, you talk about balanced guard play. These are guys that are going to hit the glass, are going to go after the boards. And when you've got the number one defense in the country in efficiency, that's going to take you a long way, and that will take you to the championship game. That's how I see it playing out. What about Kevin Ollie, the job that he has done at UConn? I remember my good old days, even with the Thunder, and having a chance to interview Kevin. I always knew that he would go somewhere very far and be a coach. I mean, he's got a great mind, that high basketball IQ.
The fact that Napier is their leading rebounder at 6'1", that's not good, because that's not going to get it done against a much taller, much more physical Florida unit here. Mm-hmm. But what I do like about this, and you mentioned it a moment ago, the job that Kevin Ollie's done to take over a program, you know, with the legendary Jim Calhoun having left a couple of seasons ago, and what this man has done, what Kevin Ollie has done, is really revitalized this program. And if you're an old school basketball fan, if you're an old school Big East fan, you can't help but love the story of UConn here. I mean, they represent the remnants of the old Big East Conference. And for me, it's a big thrill to see them here in this spot.
Enjoy the games, and I look forward to catching up with you again real soon. Okay, Steve-O?
Looking forward to it as well, Alyssa. Thank you.
You bet. Much more straight ahead this weekend at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big East Sports Show. Join us online at Twitter, at eRadio Sports.
You're listening to the Big E Sports Show on Yahoo Sports Radio. Once again, the host of the fastest 2 hours in radio, here's Alyssa Walker-Campbell.
The Big E.
Hey, we have always got you covered at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show, the fastest 2 hours in radio, and I am your host, Elissa Walker-Campbell. We love connecting with you online. Join us at Twitter, at eRadioSports. You can check out some of our videos, also at our radio website, that is eRadioSports.com. And we are so glad you made it a point to join us this evening, because right now we are going to head to Austin. We're going to visit with our friends at Horns Illustrated, the senior editor, Steve Habel, who also works for CyberGolf.com. How are you, Steve?
Hey, Elissa. Thanks for having me on again.
Well, it's great to have you on because it's certainly a big news this week with Tiger Woods opting for surgery. And as a result, he will miss the Masters for a pinched nerve that's been bothering him. What was your reaction when you heard the news?
My first reaction, Elissa, was that, well, two first reactions. The first one was it's really a shame that Tiger's not going to get to play in the Masters. The second one is that now might be the time to go to the Masters because the badges might be in short supply, or big supply for the first time in a long time. It's a shame. You know, Tiger's been fighting that back issue, and he needs to get it ready and get going because he's still got some good stuff left in his career, I think we all know.
Well, Steve, I know you've covered a ton of golf with CyberGolf.com. I mean, how optimistic are you about his future and a good return from the procedure?
Well, I think the procedure is fine. You know, he's a healthy man for the most part. You know, I'm getting less and less optimistic about Tiger getting to Nicholas's 18 majors every year. I think we all are. And these physical issues are not good for him. But, you know, I'm still a big Tiger guy. I mean, a lot of people are not, but I've always been a Tiger guy. I think, you know, he's the greatest golfer of all time, so I'm not putting anything past him.
Well, Steve, Tiger Woods, of course, is 38 years of age. I mean, is your belief, I mean, in terms of father time, is it catching up with him? Will he be able to bounce back and perhaps get that elusive major number 15 because he seems to be stuck on 14?
Well, I think that Tiger is an old 38, Alyssa. Obviously, his body's been through a lot. He's one of the violent swingers of the golf club on tour, and that really will cut down on things. He's no Ernie Els or no Jordan Spieth as far as ease of swinging the golf club, but I think the Tiger's still got some golf left in him. I think that, you know, the game as a whole owes so much to Tiger, and it's really a shame to see people ready to put him out to pasture this early.
Well, he certainly had a lot of success even in 2013. I know he didn't win a major, but it's been, 6 years since Tiger Woods has won his last major. I know it's so disappointing as we're talking about he's not going to be participating in the Masters. He's been in every one since 1995 when he was, an amateur. You know that's going to impact the television ratings, right?
I think any time that Tiger's not in a tournament, just in the basic tournaments every week that we have, if he's not playing, the interest in the tournament goes down considerably. I think that's been proven. The greatest thing that could happen for somebody like me who's in the golf industry and covers golf for a living and for the game of golf as a whole is for Tiger to be healthy and winning. It's always been that case since he's been on the scene. He just creates interest in the game. So, yeah, it's going to be the Masters, and it's going to still go on, but it's not going to be quite the same without Tiger, that's for sure.
Well, we certainly love Tiger for what he has been able to accomplish out there on the golf course, but what about this new generation, these up-and-comers golfers that are coming up? Like Jordan Spieth, you had an opportunity last weekend at the Valero, the Texas Open, to follow him, correct?
I did. I followed Spieth since he was in high school and an amateur player. He is a really fun guy to watch play. He wears his emotions on his sleeve, a little bit like Tiger did, and does still, but he... You know, this younger generation owes so much to Tiger because of his ability to understand, to make the game more accessible, and the fact that these guys are just fearless now. I mean, all these young guys that are winning on tour owe so much of that, you know, that chutzpah, as it were, to the fact that Tiger was kind of putting that out, not being too deferential to the older guys, respecting them but not being in their back pocket. And it's Spieth is an amazing guy to watch. I mean, he is a rookie of the year last year, and every time you go see him, he's kind of liable to pull something out of his hat, just like Tiger Woods when he was young.
You know, that's a great comparison, too, because he really is one of the up-and-coming, the rising stars, only 20 years old, Jordan Spieth. I'd love for you to speak, too, because you cover golf so much, Steve, the parity that we are seeing now on the tour with these younger players and the impact.
Yeah, and I think that's good for the game. But at the same time, I also think it's good for the game to have a dominant figure, a Phil Mickelson or a Tiger Woods or a Nicholas or an Arnie. Even though when Nicholas was at his prime, he still had Arnie and, Gary Player and Lee Trevino to deal with. The young guys are just so talented now. They hit it so far and are kind of fearless on the greens. You know, the greens are running so fast, and they're used to playing that way now. But I think it's a double-edged sword. It's good for the game because everybody thinks they could win out on tour, but at the same time, you'd like to have a dominant guy out there that everybody can go to all the time.
Steve Habel is joining us this evening at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. He is the senior editor with Horns Illustrated, also works with CyberGolf.com. I just mentioned last weekend you were in San Antonio at the Valero Texas Open, and Stephen Bowditch gets his first ever PGA Tour win and earns a late invite to his very first Masters. I mean, this is a guy that's really battled through some dark times, but I mean, to see him get, you know, with the finish and the win, I mean, it was huge.
Yeah, Bowditch kind of gutted it out. It was a tough, tough day on Sunday in San Antonio. The wind was blowing about 25 constant and up to 35 with gusts. And at that golf course, you turn back into the wind for the first five holes of the back nine. So it's he actually gave away three strokes in his first three holes for the day. And at that time, Spieth was making a charge. He had made three birdies on the front side, and he would look like he might get in contention. Bowditch kind of wobbled home, or as I wrote in my story, he leaked oil all the way across the finish line. But he found a way to win. And it's really a credit to his stick-to-itiveness and his moxie to battle through some of the stuff he's gone through in his career.
Steve Habel has been with us at YSR, the Big E Sports Show. We are quickly running out of time. 30 seconds, Steve. Just give us a quick pulse on how things are unfolding in terms of, let's talk about your Longhorns, the spring practice report. What's coming on at camp there?
Well, we saw Coach Strong yesterday. We actually had a chance to talk to him, and he said that he had to start practice over midway through because he wasn't excited about the enthusiasm he was seeing and the way they were going. And that's been kind of the way it's been this spring, and since Strong's been here, he's putting his stamp on the program, and he's not taking any bunk from any of those guys. So it's a new sheriff in town, and it's Charlie Strong.
That's right, and changing the culture. Steve Habel, been with us at YSR, the Big E Sports Show. Take care, Steve. We'll talk to you soon. Thank you.
Thanks, Alyssa.
Okay, we'll be right back with much more of the Big E Sports Show.
You're listening to the Big E Sports Show on Yahoo Sports Radio. Once again, the host of the fastest 2 hours in radio, here's Alyssa Walker-Campbell.
The Big E.
Okay, Alyssa Walker-Campbell, I want to welcome you back to Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. And we are always encouraging you to join us online at Twitter. Follow us on Twitter at eRadioSports and also our radio website, eRadioSports.com. Well, we are gearing up for another very special interview as it's going to be the 118th running of the Boston Marathon, the world's oldest, and a marathon that is certainly so historic and has such a special place in our hearts, especially when you think back what happened a year ago, the city of Boston, how they really responded and came together after those tragic bombings. The Boston Marathon, if you did not know, it's going to get underway later this month on the 21st. And so this evening, we have invited to our show the senior writer with the New England Runner magazine. He also has a new book out, The Boston Marathon, A Celebration of America's Greatest Race. And that, of course, is Tom Dierdien. How are you tonight, Tom?
I'm happy to be with you.
Well, we are so glad that you are with us, and let me just break it all down, because the Boston Marathon is certainly unique for several reasons. Every year, it has an abundance of world-class runners, and it just seems like the desire to be a part of this year's race really spiked. It went up. There is a total of 36,000 runners that have signed up. That's an incredible field, and certainly an incredible demand of runners in this particular race. How much does that affect in terms of, I mean, I know there's going to be heightened security, Tom, but are you surprised to see that the field was expanded with that number of participants in such limited space?
I am not surprised, because it was done before in 96 for the 100th running of the marathon. So then a lot of people wanted to run, and the towns and cities along the way and the BAA accommodated such large numbers of runners. The road is long, but the road is also narrow, and the towns are really subject to a lot of stress when this river of runners cuts them in half. These are small towns. The town that the race starts in, Hopkinton, has a population of 13,000. So 13,000 people are putting on a party for 36,000 people. That's crowded.
That is definitely credit, and it's overwhelming. And I know that we're going to talk about that some more with the new book that you have out on the Boston Marathon. What are some of the biggest challenges in terms of just logistically, when you talk about the time, the space, just to maintain that high standard and not diminish the experience to be when you want to be a part of the Boston Marathon? And it's not easy because you've got to qualify for this.
Yes, it's above all, since its inception, an athletic event. So it's not a parade. It's not a health and fitness event, although those are parts of it. There's pageantry, there's celebration, and in this year there's defiance and patriotism. After all, the race is on Patriots Day. But it's still an athletic event, and running well is the whole point of it. Is racing is the whole point of it. Finishing as high as possible is the point. And at the Boston Marathon, the field is limited because you have to qualify to get in. The only other marathons in the country where you have to qualify is the Olympic trials and, of course, the Olympics themselves. So it's a high-level athletic event.
Yes, absolutely. Tom Dedarian, the senior writer with the New England Runner magazine and also the author of his new book, the commemorative edition, The Boston Marathon, A Celebration of America's Greatest Race, is joining us this evening at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. Tom, you just mentioned you're a runner. You have trained. You've ran marathons through the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. What was your experience like to be a part of this race, and how did you get into running?
I got into running the ordinary way when my friend in high school said, "Hey, let's go off the track." I said, "Oh, okay."
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's how kids get into things, just because a friend says so. But I was running track in high school for a couple of years before I decided, for who knows what reason. I mean, why do people decide they want to be good at something? I decided I want to get good at this. And I started training and learned that if I train more than anybody else, I beat them and began to win lots of races throughout high school, went to college and continued in the same direction. And after that, the marathon became the next challenge and the challenge to qualify for the Olympic trials, which I did on two occasions. So to me, the fascination was always the racing.
And I understand, going through your bio too, Tom, you finished as high as, 18th place back in 75. What was your time?
2:19. That time would place about the same now as it did then.
Tom Dedarian is joining us this evening at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. We were just talking about that you have had the experience, the opportunity to be a part of this race. But share with us now, what makes this book different than most books that are on the Boston Marathon? Because from what I understand and going through it, I mean, you really give the perspective from the spectators and the residents, not just the runners.
The first book I wrote was a definitive history of the race from the point of view of the athletic contest, from the point of view of who was going to beat who. What did they do to prepare? Who was facing whom, and where they came from, and what they were willing to do to win the race. So it was, in that sense, a historical sports book. This new book is from the point of view of the other two sides of the road, not the middle of the road with the runners in it, racing each other, but how it affects the communities and what it means to the people who have been watching the race. After all, the Boston Marathon is special in that, unlike other races, it's been around longer. Unlike the Olympic Marathon, it's held in a different city every 4 years. The Boston Marathon's on the same course, and the same people, it passes the same houses, goes to the same towns, and has become part of the culture of those towns and part of the culture of the families who are along the way. They have regular marathon parties every year, and generations have watched. People can stand there and say, this is where I watched with my father, with my grandfather. This is where I was watching when Kelly won in 1957, and so on. So they're grounded in history by their spectating the race.
Well, I love your book. I mean, it really is a celebration of America's greatest race, and it really shows, you illustrate throughout the book that the marathon is each town. I mean, they really take a tremendous amount of pride of being a part of that. It's not just about the 26 miles in the Boston area, right?
I will confess this. Here's a secret that maybe everyone around does not know, that the Boston Marathon is mostly not in Boston. Only the last couple of miles are in Boston. So to call it the Boston Marathon, it probably should be called the Marathon to Boston.
Mm-hmm.
It starts in the little town of Hopkinton, it goes through the little town of Ashland. Each town has a separate character. Ashland is a town that started as Clock City. They made the first electric clocks in the country, maybe the world, in Ashland, Massachusetts. The next town of Framingham is different. Natick is different. Each town has its own characteristics, its own economy. They're very different, and their approaches to the marathon are different, yet they have to unify in order to accommodate the marathon by doing things like fixing the road, coordinating the DPW activity. They have to station their firefighters on each side of the road because the community is cut in half. So they have to anticipate the coming of the marathon and are very welcoming, even though it is an expensive undertaking. There's a lot of overtime that's paid to police and fire to accommodate the race.
The senior writer with the New England Runner magazine, Tom Dedarian, has been joining us this evening at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. The title of his brand new book that's just been released, the commemorative edition, The Boston Marathon, A Celebration of America's Greatest Race. So just tell us, I mean, what is it like as a resident? I mean, when you've got 30 plus runners descending on your town, I mean, how overwhelming is that? That's got to be really difficult. I mean, what do? Just shut it down for that whole weekend?
Well, 36,000 people going to come to the little town of Hopkinton, and can I say this on the radio? They all have to pee at the same time. That takes a lot of accommodating. Just banks and banks of porta-johns. I mean, just for a little thing. And they all have to get there, too. That's the town doesn't have a lot of daily transportation for 30,000 people. So fleets of buses have to take runners from Boston out to Hopkinton to the start.
Tom, what kind of history do you provide? I mean, I know there's some trivia in there. I mean, I didn't know Ronald McDonald won the Boston Marathon in 1898 while he was a student at Boston College. True?
Yeah, that is true. Yes, that, of course, nothing to do with the burger chain. He was from Nova Scotia. He was a medical student and went on to be a doctor. And that was his name, Ronald McDonald. There is a story of lighthearted story of Rosie Ruiz, who jumped into the race with a mile to go, and the officials, with not a lot of security back in the early 80s, put the laurel wreath on her head and declared her the winner. And she was a complete, absolute fraud and a cheat.
Mm.
And she got away with it and swore that she ran the whole thing. And it was definitely shown that she did not. That year I was working for a radio station announcing from the 20-mile mark, and I announced all the runners who came by, and she wasn't one of them. So she tricked everyone. Later she turned out to be kind of a drug dealer and a crook, too. And then there's, of course, the much more serious bombing of last year. That is chronicled by a story in the book of how runners were approaching Boston and told to stop. Here they were running and running, and people along the way, thousands and thousands of people shouting, go, 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 and suddenly they hear, stop. Stop. I mean, runners don't want to hear stop.
Right.
At first, they were angry that they were told to stop. This is what they had trained for. This is what their minds were set on. They wanted to stop after the finish line, and they were prevented from approaching the finish line. And, of course, they had no idea why. They thought, at first, what is this, a bunch of drunken students in the road blocking the way? Is this some kind of joke? Only after a long time did they realize the seriousness of the bombing. The people were hurt and killed.
Right. And of course, in your book, five members of the Greater Boston Track Club, they want to run the marathon again to show their defiance of the bombings. And that's all detailed in there. Well, it's been a true pleasure, Tom, having you with us this evening at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. Again, we want to encourage you to go ahead and get a copy of the commemorative edition, The Boston Marathon, a celebration of America's greatest race. One day, one race, one Boston. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
That once again was Tom Dedarian, the senior writer with the New England Runner magazine, who has his new book out on the Boston Marathon. And we want to pause and take time to thank all of our guests, our lineup, the Dallas Mavericks television play-by-play announcer, the great Mark Folliwell, of course, Timothy Mullen, the author of Baseball Road Trips, Stephen Bornstein from Fox Sports Radio New Mexico, Jason Peter with our weekly Under the Helmet segment, and Steve Habel, the senior editor with Horns Illustrated. Be sure and don't drink and drive. We'll see you next weekend for the biggest, the best in sports, the Big E Sports Show. Join us online at Twitter @eRadioSports, and we will see you next week.